Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Perry Myers, who is a professor of German studies at Albion College. We'll be talking about a brand new Palgrave Macmillan publication, Spiritual Empires in Europe and India. And the subtitle is Cosmopolitan Religious Movements from 1875 to the Interwar Era. Perry, welcome to the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Oh, you're most welcome. No, there has to be a backstory to this, or at very least, share with us how a professor of German studies writes what could be thought of as a political science or even religious studies book.
Yeah, that's the perfect question. Unfortunately, the backstory may turn into a dissertation itself.
Perfect.
I had a prior career to academics. Let me begin that way. I was an investment banker working for American investment banks in Germany. And so I had a prior education. I have an MBA. This was prior to my PhD. And then I, living in Germany, I've read in all of my free time, literature and sociology of religion and everything else, and traveled to London frequently. And because I grew up in the Southwest United States, I like spicy food. And so I got interested in India through the food originally. And then when I started working on my PhD post investment banking career, I focused mostly on the late 19th century and early 20th century, and I realized that almost every German intellectual, whether they were a literary figure or a sociology of religions person like Max Weber, they had all written something on India. And that's kind of the backstory. So I started in my PhD dissertation, I worked a little bit on Rudolf Steiner, who borrowed quite a bit from his interpretation of Hindu thought. And that just kind of steamrolled into this larger comparative project that developed into this book eventually. The book in between my dissertation and this book was about German visions of India, and focus specifically on how Germans traveled to India, wrote about India during the Wilhelmine period or pre-World War I period primarily. And then this book, this went to a different place and expanded to cosmopolitan religious movements in India, Germany, France, and England. So that's the sort of the
there's the backstory. There's much to be said about German Indology. And there's also much to be said about the love of spice leading one to India. I believe Columbus himself set sail in search for spice, but who knows? spiritual empires. What's a spiritual empire?
Well, that's the back end of the book. Or the conclusion of the book. The book is basically divided up into two halves, you might say, because since I was dealing with multiple countries, for comparative purposes, the front end of the book served as a survey of what made these various religious movements, or what commonalities these various religious movements had. And I discovered that they actually had quite a few, even though their iterations and how they became organized and so forth and so on was very, very different in each country. They were all sort of addressing the same set of problems in a similar way. And some of those affinities were they tended to all be anti-materialist, for instance. They didn't, and to clarify a bit, they didn't reject the material world. They weren't ascetic, but they felt like it had become too dominant in society, culture, and in their nations. And so they were attempting to sort of rebalance the spiritual world and the material world. And another affinity is that they were all universalist in their views about spirituality, and they all developed some kind of form of spiritual science. They all believed or supported the theories of Darwinian evolution, except they took those theories into the spiritual world and developed a theory of spiritual science, which suggested that spirituality evolves or progresses over time. And out of that, they developed really what is a historiography of spirituality. And this gets to the back end of the book. Once I've established those affinities of these various religious movements, the back half of the book then depicts how these movements became idiosyncratic or specific to their own nations. So in other words, German cosmopolitan religious thinkers envisioned some kind of spiritual empire that was Germanocentric, as did the French in a different way. So they were taking the same set of spiritual affinities and ideologies and thoughts, but they were applying them in their own nations, and in the case of England, empire, in a different way to create sort of a Francocentric spiritual empire. So that's sort of where spiritual empires comes from, the term.
When you say they or the religious movements, which ones in particular are you looking at in your book?
There are several different ones. Theosophy is one of the primary ones. It was most prevalent in Germany, England, and India. Theosophy sort of petered out fairly quickly, or in France. I think Madame Blavatsky and some of the early French cosmopolitan religious leaders did not get along very well. In Germany, once Blavatsky had passed away, Annie Besant became the president of the Theosophical Society. She did not get along very well with Rudolf Steiner, who had been the vice president or the president of the German Theosophical Society. They had a falling out, and he developed his own religious movement called Anthroposophy. Monism developed in Germany, was another one of these movements, but never really developed to any significant degree, to my knowledge, in England, France, or India. So those are sort of the main religious movements that I deal with in the book.
So your comparative examination of these movements, as you mentioned at the outset, across these three parallels, what would you say is the ultimate purpose or takeaway? What are you arguing essentially in the book?
Well, when I get to the second half of the book, what I'm actually arguing, I think, in very general terms, is that even though some of the motivations for these religious groups and their leaders was commendable, I think they saw some of the negative components or aspects of industrial capitalism and a materialistic worldview and the industrialization of military force. And I think those were responses that were very positive. But once they began to apply their attempts to renovate or rejuvenate spirituality, they became very bogged down in their own political environments. So in other words, and the second thing is they were elitist in their nature, and therefore, as they became established in their own countries, the French version became sort of this Catholic-esque, I use that term in the book, Catholic-esque kind of organization that saw France as the center of this new spiritual empire that would develop and renovate or rejuvenate spirituality throughout the world. But it was French-based at that point. And the same is true with Ani Besant and the Indian Theosophists. The Indian Theosophists were, of course, anti-colonial, but surprisingly, they were not necessarily anti-empire. They envisioned a new spiritual empire in which they were equals to the British that would dominate the world spiritually, not militarily or anything like that. So the bottom line is that these movements, in their attempt to solve a real issue and a problem, became political and nationalistic in their own sort of idiosyncratic way.
Would you say they became political, or would you say that may have been and always been sort of underlying theme or motivation?
I think you're right. I think they're inseparable.
No, it's an open question.
I think they, from the very beginning, you can probably say that's true, because there's not this magical moment in time where they suddenly shifted to a more political mindset. So while many of their writings have these implications of political and social applications from the very beginning, so I don't think there's ever a separation. I think for the purposes of the book, it was important to show their affinities, because the question then becomes, you know, why compare them at all if they don't have something in common? And so I think that's why the book is separated into those two halves. But I think in many ways they were political from the very beginning. I mean, Ani Besant, way back in the 19th century, before she was a theosophist, wrote what was for then a very radical book promoting birth control. I mean, this was a really radical idea. And she was a member of the Fabian Society, a socialist group, and then she became acquainted with Blavatsky and her writing. So she was very politically active prior to becoming a theosophist.
In my armchair theorizing on religion, perhaps being a scholar of religion, my armchair is a little more worn than most, but in my armchair theorizing about religion, in the back of my brain, it's always sort of the love child of the socio-political and the psycho-spiritual. And it's, you know, where one ends and the other begins, it can take a bit of work to discern that, but there are always these worldly, mundane, very real and often ugly pressures and aspects. Mm-hmm. These are what are focused on when you take an hermeneutic of suspicion, for example. Mm-hmm. And then certainly there are other elements, more uplifting, perhaps spiritual elements. This term spiritual, I recently did a talk at a public university on Indian spirituality and its use. They were interested in its use in my particular learning platforms and coaching practice and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Do you grapple with how you're using this term, or what spirituality means, or how to define it?
Yeah, I try to depict it the way they depict it. In other words, I use it the way they saw it. So the term spirituality, in how they used it, may not fit very well into a religious studies context in a different environment with a different set of parameters from a different perspective. They saw spirituality as something scientific, something that could be traced historically. As a matter of fact, the Byzant General Hadassah, who was one of the primary Indian theosophists, Charles Barlet was one of the French cosmopolitan religious leaders, and then the monist Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, Wilhelm Ostwald in Germany. He won the Nobel Prize in chemistry in 1909. So these are serious. This is a serious academic to be taken as legitimate. They all wrote texts on occult chemistry. Ostwald called it something else, but they were tracing somehow the spirituality embedded in chemical processes. So I tried to stay true to their understanding of spirituality rather than trying to make a contribution to the understanding of the term spirituality in a broader academic context. That makes
perfect sense to me. I mean, for me, my role is to provide a platform and space to examine the book and perhaps tease out some of its implications for other mm-hmm. disciplines and subfields. And so I ask these more generative than limiting questions. And so, yeah, I mean, I personally feel that it's practical and appropriate that what you're doing is you're not theorizing what spirituality is. Spirituality is actually not your theoretical model. It's your data. Because yeah. they're using that yeah. term and you're yeah. presenting.
What they did with it is what I'm getting at. And I think one of the things that I would like to add to that too is all of these cosmopolitan religious writers and leaders, I think they were very aware of not being taken as legitimate. Esoteric religions are frequently not taken seriously and not taken as legitimate movements. And I think these people, even though they didn't specifically say that, I think they were very aware of it. And so they attempted to create a theory of spirituality that's could be proposed as scientific. That's why they wrote these texts like, occult chemistry.
Would you say, how would you characterize the relationship between science and spirituality as presented in these movements? Because you seem to say that they're fairly uniform in their approach. So would that be something along the lines of spirituality can be subsumed by science or measured by science? Or has it what's the relationship? Could you clarify?
I think what they were trying to do, I'm not sure I know. What the relationship between science and spirituality?
No, is. I mean their view thereof.
What they were trying to do is they were trying to say that they are equal partners, that to separate, and they write this actually, to separate the objective world and the subjective world, to separate the material world from the physical world, from the spiritual world, is a falsification of knowledge. That's how they would answer that question. So they have to be merged. You have to be doing both. You can't, not you, but they would say you cannot do science without spirituality. And you can't do spirituality without science.
Yeah, so just to drill down on this a little bit, would they believe that spirituality can be measured in the way that empirical reality can be?
Yes, they would. And yes, they would, because this is the sort of the part of the essence of their these occult chemistry texts that they wrote. They have an astonishing deep understanding of then current chemistry. they go through Besant, and this was a co-authored book. Lidbetter, Besant, and Generadasa, for instance, wrote the it's sort of a pamphlet length book, about 100 pages on occult chemistry, and they trace all of the known atoms and their chemical compounds and their chemical makeup, and then an attempt to show how you can find spirituality, and I'm simplifying a bit, but they try to clarify how that corroborates a spiritual understanding of the world in terms of physical chemistry. And even a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry wrote a book called Die Energie in German. It's the energy. And he saw this, the chemical world, or the which is basically all physical matter, as being somehow supported by this
infused energy with some divine presence, right?
Yeah,
infused
some kind of, right? You know, and Monist would never use that word divine.
Well, it's he's being careful, obviously, for his professional purposes.
Yeah, because they rejected religion, so to speak.
Yes, it sounds like it sounds a little bit like perhaps wanting to have your cake and eat it too.
That's always the case. I mean, great. when we read these texts now, we think, "Oh, this is ridiculous," because we are so scientifically driven, but our understanding of the world is so scientifically biased, let's say. But, they were very cognizant of being legitimate, I think, and trying. So that's why they really understood chemistry.
Well, I find it utterly fascinating, and it probably in these times this would be considered pseudoscience. We think of it as pseudoscience. So why I particularly find this fascinating is that I teach in a variety of contexts from a variety of perspectives. So obviously academic teaching, I teach undergrads here and there. I have contracts. Currently I'm teaching undergrads. Mm-hmm. Continuing studies at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies or other online platforms. And then there are more emic paradigms where people want esoterica or Hindu spirituality. And in certain spaces like my online school, I dovetail both. Here's the academic, you know, if we're talking about the history of Indian religions, we're not going to use numbers that we find in the Puranas or the epics. We're going to think scientifically about what happened on this plane. And yet, if I'm interpreting mythological texts, the implications are for the psycho-spiritual inner realm or the journey towards being more aware. And I come across this every once in a while where some of my students want to express spiritual truths through scientific terms. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if there's a belief in astrology or the power of astrology, it's because of the gravity of the grahas of the planets. And they sometimes seem surprised when I say to them, because I often give a great deal of spiritual wisdom teachings, I say, look, that's pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. I mean, science is a methodology that facilitates understanding the material world and the forces therein.
Yeah.
And so if you believe that the grahas, the planets, have an impact on your psyche, it's not through gravity or electromagnetism. That's ludicrous. But there may be another mode or another realm or another order of reality whereby there are forces that can't be perceived, perhaps subtle forces, perhaps it works by virtue of synchronicity when you cast a chart, right? So this it seems sensible to have this division of labor. Like for a scientific inquiry or problem, there's one mode, and for spirituality, or we have no shortage of data for ESP or occult phenomenon, but we can't necessarily grapple with it through empirical means. So I find it so fascinating that they're able to push this envelope in their epoch. And unless I'm mistaken, you would know best, they seem to have gotten away with it. Like it wasn't really critiqued.
There are occasional critiques, even within their own cohorts. For instance, I think Sinnott, who was one of the British theosophist wrote a text on volcanoes, and he wrote quite a bit of stuff on what we would consider geology these days. And but they always use these scientific platforms to prove some underlying spiritual component to them. And I know one of the other theosophists at the time took real issue with how he had interpreted his assessment of geology. But at the same time, confirmed that this still proves that there is some kind of astral plane or spiritual universe that these texts show. So they're, it's like you said before, there is, I think it's fair to say, in their work, it is a have your cake and eat it too, a kind of scientific effort, because they simply, by our expectations of what is justifiable scientific results, they simply bent those rules pretty significantly to make their points.
So one of the elements of the MO of yours truly in the podcast is big picture, big ideas, 30,000 foot view, both for the sake of accessibility and engagement outside of the weeds of our particular niche, but also for the love of ideas. And so in addition to the science spirituality tension, another that comes to mind is this sacred secular divide. Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit about that in this context?
Yes, it was actually quite important to them because they felt like this is a part of the spiritual material divide that had made the world such a sick place in their view during that period of time. And so the secular world they would have seen as having become material, obsessed with materialism and objectivity, or the objective world, the physical world. And they wanted to, just like with spirituality and material views of the world, they wanted to reconnect the secular world. And that's where the spiritual empires part of the book really takes becomes forceful, in that it shows how every different movement in every different country is really attempting to reconnect the secular world with the spiritual world. And that's where these movements become political. None of these people ever ran for office, not that kind of political, but they wanted to create a secular world that was primarily informed by their version of spirituality. So I think this thread goes through everything they did. Anything that's not spiritual needs to be re-spiritualized, in other words, including the secular world.
Were these various groups simply in isolation, a product of their times, and that's why they have this approach, or were they borrowing from each other? Otherwise put, how do you account for the similarity across them?
Well, I think they were borrowing from each other, because at this time in Europe at the end of the 19th century, was publication of materials began to become cheaper. Newspapers and journals became more widespread, and they were pervasive publishers of articles and journals. And I know some of the German theosophists had some of their work translated into English, and some of Blavatsky's texts, if you go back and look at those German journals that were published by the theosophists, you'll see some of Blavatsky's texts in that time period published in German. These texts were available in France and in India. And these people, for the most part, many of them traveled. So they interacted quite a bit. And I'm sure there was a significant amount of idea exchange through those interactions as well. So it's not just they read each other's work, but I think they also interacted. Blavatsky and Henry Steele Alcott, who was an American, actually founded Theosophy in New York originally, moved to Adyar or near Chennai, today's Chennai in India, and then back to London. And then, so there was this, it was a new international network, so to speak, that emerged during this period of time. So that's, I'm sure that's how the ideas became
disseminated.
Yeah.
What, are there any core ideas or texts from Indian religions that you see influential in these movements?
Well, it's their readings of these texts. They refer to the Vedas and they refer to the Puranas and they refer to Indian texts, but not in the original text. It's their version or their reference. They quote these texts, but they quote them in their context and in their interpretation. For instance, one of the for these movements to reconnect spirituality to the secular world, for instance, they needed a mechanism. And that mechanism for most of these groups, especially the ones that were very oriented positively oriented towards Indian religious thought, was karma. And they wrote a lot about karma, but
I was hoping you would say that.
I'm not sure it's the karma. I'm not sure it's the karma that you would recognize in an Indian study, in a religious, a study of Indian religions. I'm not sure it's that same karma, because I used the term in the book, you may have seen it, merit-based karma. I mean, that's merit-based. For instance, the German theosophists argued that merit determines your karma. And
that's different from karmic theory in a classical sense, you think?
Well, I'm not sure.
Karma insofar as meritorious and unmeritorious, or papa and punya, or however you want to define them in English, that these actions have, you know, a residue on you, and you have, yes, to bear the results. So just so I understand, or anyone listening understands, when you're saying meritorious karma as different from in the Indic, in the classical Indic context, how do you mean that? How do you mean the difference?
What I do in the book is I don't really make that comparison. What I do in the book is I explain how they used it. And what they did is, in essence, they used it as a means to explain why some parts of the population are incredibly impoverished and others are not. And they say this, especially in the German context, this is in their writings, that your karma is deserved. So if you are poor, it's because of your own behavior. And this is where I think that mechanism becomes very elitist, because most of these cosmopolitan religious leaders in all of these countries do not come from impoverished classes. They're all very well educated. They're all in the elite, so to speak, intellectually at least. And there is an element of protecting that class position in their work as well.
So in your view, their use of karma was a convenient means of justifying their privilege and their position.
Yes. And that became transformed into national merit as well. In other words, civilizations also have meritorious karma or lack thereof, and therefore are more capable of leading the empire of the world spiritually.
Ah, the slippery slope of interpretation.
The slippery slope of religion slipping into politics. And that's the primary, that's the bottom line of the book.
Say more about that last thought, especially why it might be applicable or meaningful. Obviously, you know, one of the things that fascinates me about scholars is they spend forever eking out a particular niche. And some scholars are really aware of why they care and why it matters, and some aren't. And I do my best to bring that out, irrespective of whether or not they're aware of why their book is important.
Yeah.
But you seem to be fairly aware of why is that important? Why is that? What is the point of your book? Something that we should be thinking about or in these times.
Because I think, you know, my point is not to degrade religion. My point is not to make some kind of claim that, you know, religion is just, you know, just one more political thing that we should get rid of or disrespect. My point is that we should be able to recognize when religion does that, though. When it does become political, when it does become biased, when it is used as a means to suppress, to carve out advantage vis-a-vis other people or other nations. And this is what these cosmopolitan religious movements at the time did to a certain degree, or at least attempted to do. They didn't really do it successfully, but they attempted to carve out this position of merit among their leadership that then they transposed onto the British spiritual empire or the Francocentric empire or the Germanocentric spiritual empire that should spew great wisdom to the world. But that connection becomes very problematic always when my spiritual worldview suddenly becomes imposed on someone else's. And this is, I think, what I would want people to take away from the book.
Fascinating. Were there any other aspects of the book you hoped we would touch on today?
I think we've just about covered it all. The one thing that I would want to reiterate again, is the elitist element of these people. This is true of the Indian theosophists, the French. They were all very
people elite. Of privilege.
They were privileged and elitist in their thinking, and there seems to be this kind of underlying philosophy, ideology, or mechanism to preserve their status. For instance, the Germans were very keen on becoming Germanic Brahmins, for instance. And they use that term. And
so please continue.
They also defend the caste system. They given, say it's been abused in modern terms, but it needs to go back to its origins.
Given the ethos of hierarchy and the perpetuation of privilege that we see here, by means of perhaps an appropriation of ideas from elsewhere, it's all the more interesting that the philosophy of moksha, karma, samsara comes not from those at the apex of a caste system, but for those who have decided to opt out of it in order to realize that wisdom.
Yeah. But that's not what was happening with the people that I studied. They saw themselves as a revamped, rejuvenated Brahmin class of leaders who would reconnect spirituality with the physical world and create an empire, a spiritual empire.
I like the tension of that title. It's, as I say, for me, I mean, I crudely simplify in order to understand. Obviously, everything needs to be problematized and eked out. But in terms of religion being this sort of love child between the psycho-spiritual and the socio-political, that's encapsulated so nicely in that, in the spiritual empires, right?
Yeah,
in some ways it's a contradiction. In other ways, it might be quite apt in this particular case.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Perry Myers on his brand new Palgrave Macmillan book, Spiritual Empires in Europe and India. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening. Do your best to take care of yourself in these times and keep contemplating the interplay of spirituality and politics. Take care.